Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Wilkinson presiding, is now opening the transaction of any business that may be listed in the court.
Good morning. Before we proceed with the first case this morning, the court would like to note that this is a first for us. Today is the first time that the oral arguments of this court will be carried live over the internet and can be found on our South Dakota Supreme Court homepage. We do not have the new equipment installed yet, so this is considered an experimental day for us, but we hope it works well. There was a lot of work that went into this, headed by Justice Konenkamp's Technology Committee, also assistance from our friends at Public Radio, and further, the arguments will be carried over the public access channel here in Pier and Fort Pier, and for that, we appreciate the help at Callahan. The permanent new equipment will be installed so that the oral arguments will be considered permanent fixtures for the November term. We hope also for the October term in Rapid City to be able to link up there. With that, we will proceed with the first case, which is Olson Rohde versus Hine and Kilcoyne. Mr. Rick Johnson for the appellants and Ms. Susan Bruning Simmons for the appellees. Mr. Johnson, you may proceed, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. Before I start my argument, I would like to state that I think the proposition that we're dealing with in this case is not a black and white issue. I think that there are some cases where exemplary damages should be permitted, where the tortfeasor has passed away, and that this is one of them. I'm not going to be here this morning and argue that in all cases that it can be survived the death of the tortfeasor, but I truly think that this is one of the cases, the area of cases, that it should be permitted.
Are you saying then that this is a preliminary decision to be made by the judge or jury call?
I think that it probably, what I'm suggesting in this case, there's parameters as to when it should be permitted, but the judge would have to make the preliminary call. Although some of the cases I cite, I have a lot of faith in what our temporary damage statutes and our instructions are to juries as to when it's reasonable, when it's fair. And I don't have a problem with that, but I do think that I don't think this court has to say it should be permitted in all cases or it should not be permitted ever.
Would it be the general rule that punitive damages are not allowed against the state?
No, it's not. No, as they say, the majority of
majority
decisions then? that have said that. You know, I ran a Westlaw on this, so there hasn't been another case since we wrote our briefs on it. But the more recent cases, I think the more recent cases, the better reasoned cases, have rejected that view, that like that Arizona case, Your Honor, that I think if you read that and try to apply
it. 31 pack seconds that you're referring to that basically didn't agree with the Braun case from before?
Well, I can't remember. I don't have the site in hand. It's a Harrelson case, I think is the name of it. I cited it in my brief several times.
Aren't you actually making a concession as to SDCL 1541? I mean, it provides already that all causes of action shall survive and be brought, notwithstanding the death of the person entitled to a viable to the same. You're saying that that doesn't mean all causes of actions. You're saying almost all causes of actions or some.
Well, I'm convinced by Appellee's response that punitive damages in and of itself is not a cause of action. I think that's correct, Your Honor. However, the other statute is 21.5.2, which says that personal injury actions do survive. The same, and I think a personal injury action, when they says that survives, I think it drags along with it the exemplary damage clause. So that would be my position on that.
If you're saying that not all claims for punitive damages should survive to death, is there some kind of rule we can apply, or is it just case by case basis?
I think particularly in a case, I think particularly in a case that we have here where we have an employment situation where the estate of the tortfeasor is enhanced, or possibly enhanced, or probably enhanced, that it, there's absolutely no sense whatsoever into allowing the heirs to take advantage of that, and that temporary damages should be appropriate in those cases. Now,
so this is an intentional tort
outside
of the workers' comp.
That's right.
The action is here,
right? And one of the reasons I think
you've got to show in that a heavy burden to show that there was just about an intent.
Well, I think, yeah, I did on that, Your Honor. Let me.
But I mean, that's what the law requires.
You bet, right. So let me.
When you say you did.
I did.
It hasn't even been to the jury yet, has it?
No, but I mean, we passed muster on summary judgment.
Okay.
Your Honor, here we have, I see most of a lot of them are here. The ladies, these ladies are up there. They're down there in this room, and this paint is not a liquid. This is a dust. It's a powder. And in 94, they discovered some of them were like 279. That's micrograms per deciliter. When you read what the doctors say about that, you know, it can cause coma, death, permanent brain damage, kidney damage, neurological damage. It's established that it does this, but it's very difficult to prove it, and a lot of times it doesn't appear for years. There's no workers' comp coverage for this, basically. They denied it, at least, because they didn't lose any, a lot of them didn't lose any time from work. They would go down and have their blood cleaned, miss an hour from work. They didn't. So they denied the workers' comp coverage. They said, well, you have to have you off work for 7 days. And it's a very difficult proof situation. You know, some of these ladies, I fear, will be ill in the coming years or develop cancer from this cadmium, which is a carcinogenic. And so I think at least under these type of circumstances, in this case, where, remember this, Your Honor, I've got two eyewitnesses that came forth. First of all, these canisters, they came in and they're like paper canisters. They look like little paper barrels. Showed that they were tearing off the warning labels off of those canisters before these ladies got a chance to see them. This employee, who's not a party in any way, it's not self-serving, he goes and he says, hey, he's got a degree from South Dakota State. He says, you can't expose these ladies to this cadmium and this lead poisoning. The air is full of it. The ventilation doesn't work right. You can't do that. And he said, what they don't know won't hurt them. That's what we're supposed to do.
When you say you proved it.
Well, I proved
I'm having a hard time. We haven't had a jury trial yet. You want to go to a jury. And what you're saying is you show that there's a genuine issue of fact
that's
that
right.
A jury should make.
Because if you proved it,
I was wondering why we're here.
No, that's true. I raised a genuine issue of material fact that Bert Van Dyke and the Van Dyke Company and his top officers all knew that they were exposing these ladies to dangerous carcinogens and to lead poisoning, and that they intentionally tore labels off to keep them from finding out about it. And when they were brought to their attention, they said, what they don't know won't hurt them. He says, how will I get anybody to paint these eyes for me if I tell them? You know? I mean, so I think I got by the material issue of fact problem on that. So next question,
you mentioned the rule that you're proposing that we should apply, and that is that where the estate of the tortfeasor is enhanced, we should apply the rule allowing the damages to succeed to the death of the tortfeasor. What evidence do you have that the estate was enhanced by this one?
Well, I couldn't get into that because I was barred from discovery of that. I do know there's a very substantial sale of this company to Cabela's, and I do know that they became the leader in the field of these eyes, these taxidermy eyes, hundreds of thousands of them, shipped all over the world. And these ladies back here did them. And they did it for years using the same ferrule paint that had the cadmium and lead in it. We know that they used it for years and years. I guess I'm jumping to conclusions, but I think that if I could see what that factory was actually sold for to Cabela's, I don't think there'd be any question about enhancing the value of this company, because I think it's millions of dollars.
That takes me right
rescind it, but you're not asking for a blanket rule in your case. You're asking for the jury to determine this question, whether a conviction be awarded, right?
I think so. I think it needs to be an open question.
If that's the case, our instructions in South Dakota on applied factors for awarding punitive damages are going to be awarded in that court. I mean, they don't address the fairness of the issues that are raised in the Arizona case that you rely on. So how would we instruct the jury? What would we tell the trial judge to instruct the jury? What are the factors that they should be told in exercising discretion on whether or not to grant these damages?
Well, I'm not sure that I'm troubled by these cases that the majority of decisions have dealt. Most of, if you look at those bigger cases, most of those cases were drunk driver cases. Most of them.
See, where that's the easy case.
Yeah, you got the wife and the children sitting at home, wringing their hands at night, waiting for their father to come home, and he runs over and kills somebody and gets killed in the same accident. Now, those cases have said it's really not a fair proposition to punish the children and wife who are at home in front of the fireplace. Now, I'm troubled by that, and that's the logic of the majority of the decision. There has not been a decision in a case like this, period, in America, where the issue comes down to whether or not a company and its owner have taken advantage of their employees, and where there's at least an issue of fact for the jury as to whether they did it intentionally. And the factory goes on and progresses and becomes larger and more important and develops into a very profitable deal.
A lot of those other cases, there can be uninsured motorist coverage or some type of insurance coverage, too, where you don't have any coverage on for an intentional act here, do you?
I've got nothing.
Now, I still need to know, though.
Oh, okay, as to what one minute.
How are we going to instruct the jury? If you want to leave this to the jury, what are we going to tell them?
Because well,
our instruction we have now doesn't address the fairness.
That's true. It does address what the value, we have to prove what if he has any money, if the estate, it's going to address the point of, well, does this estate have $10 million in it? Does it have $10,000 in it? And couldn't the lawyers go from that to argue that say, hey, it's not, you know, under the circumstances, this money should be go to these heirs, and there isn't any money left over to justify exemplary damages.
Are you saying in this case a jury would have to be instructed that with proper workplace environment, there would have been less in the estate because they would have had a lot more out-of-pocket expenses. And by avoiding those out-of-pocket expenses then, you're saying that the value of this estate has been enhanced. You mean, is a jury going to have to look at all those factors, or are you just going to go in and say, here's $100 million, we should get part of it? Or how does the court instruct on that?
Well,
it's easy to argue it, but
yeah,
how do you tell a jury what the law is?
I don't know how the court will instruct on that. It just seems a presumption to me that you have a very successful business, and I can basically prove that the sacrificing and safety of these people to make that business successful, and it was very successful, I should be able to present that to the jury.
You seem to be arguing that it should be at least, or it should be to the extent that it enhanced the estate. No more.
Well, I didn't mean to say that, I guess, to that extent, because that'd be very difficult to prove. That'd be almost impossible to prove. The judge is right. I can't go in there and prove to us that there's 200-300 employees. We're talking about one department here.
Well, you don't have to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. You have to prove it to you. When you bring in an expert, and I guess that's not my problem, but yours. But you bring in an expert, and he gives an opinion that's up to the jury to believe it.
Well, I hope that I wouldn't have to prove the amount that it enhanced it. I think I can put in evidence and the jury can decide whether or not that this was something. You know, a thought that I had, for example, a similar situation, I was thinking about this Enron situation. What about one of these guys that is basically defrauded the stockholders and the public out of millions of dollars and then commit suicide? Does that mean where he's enhanced his estate to his heirs? Does that mean that he cannot be punitive damages there? I just see situations, economic issues that seem to me to be different in some of these cases of the drunk driver.
That would bring up a very good point. If you you're not asking for a per se rule, what kind of a case would not warrant punitive damages after death? And what kind of a rule are you asking us to adopt for trial courts to decide which cases they should primarily allow the jury to look at and which ones they should not?
Well, I think that in the case of intentional torts in the employment or in the economic area, that I think that this, that they can, if there's any, if there's evidence that they've profited in some way or should have profited or benefited or the estate benefited, that I don't think they should be able to escape exemplary damages.
I haven't seen a rule in the cases that...
None of the cases have said that.
They help us decide that these non-per se cases when the judge should let it go to the jury and the judge should not.
The Arizona case, which I still like, is the last one that really has addressed all of these issues. You know, it says they were comfortable in their statutes that a jury, we have to give them enough credit to be able to decide these issues fairly. And I don't know, you're saying, well, what should more should we put in the instructions? I'm not quite ready to tell you exactly what it should be, but I thought that the Arizona case said that there are certainly circumstances where the jury, we should trust the jury to allow. And rather than to just say, no way, Jose, you can't get caught, all of these things die with the disease.
But my question is before that, now I'm concerned about when do we let the judge, or what do we tell the judge, if this kind of case should go to the jury and this case should not, because you're not asking for a blanket rule of everything.
The judge still has to make the preliminary ruling as to whether or not there's probable cause to justify exemplary damages.
You're not arguing that a lot of it should go to the jury in every case. That's what I heard you say.
I think I'm not arguing that. No, I don't think...
You're not going to make that decision.
Well...
The trial judge has to make the initial decision.
I think that particularly in cases in the economic... In the economic realm, when there's an economic issue, whether it's theft from an old lady or theft from an Enron stockholder or exposing your employees to this, in that economic realm, I certainly think, I don't know whether that's true or not. But to me, it makes sense that the rule should, I should be able to proceed in that realm. Now, whether I don't like the idea myself about the drunk driver. Having a wife and children at home. I don't like that. I'm sure that doesn't happen.
What cases are you on?
Well, I think where the conduct would have nothing to do with the accumulation of property to the estate, I think that maybe that those areas are should not be allowed.
Did you sue the corporation here? Because I know in that Arizona case, they said that you could go after the corporation, too.
It's not incorporated, but I did sue the company.
Yeah, okay.
I sued Burt Van Dyke and Van Dyke Supply, but it was a sole proprietorship, is what they proved to me. And then he sold that in 95 to Cabela's. Yeah,
so if I... Go ahead and answer.
Go ahead. That's fine. Yeah.
What you are saying then is the standard should be if there was substantial monetary gain by the tortfeasor, that punitive damages should be allowed against the state. That you're saying if there was not substantial, it should not be.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I didn't throw the word substantial.
Well, I mean, are you going to say because there's $5 passing? Yeah. Well, that's the thing I'm worried about. Well, there's $5 here, so we get punitive.
I'm trying to walk a tightrope here on the matter, but I really think that it's wrong to allow. I don't think substantial is the word, but maybe if that's a factor that the jury should consider, maybe that's a factor that needs to be plugged into the punitive damage.
Don't you think it's always walking on the edge when you don't cite as to a lot of authority? And it's really a new theory.
That's true. Although I have cited quite a few cases in there, Your Honor, that I like their rationale, and you'll find out that ones that are there.
But they just, in those cases, held that if you can, just go against the estate. And a lot of them dealt with what is the purpose of punitive damage? Is it punishment of that? And then there's a lot of rules I thought said punishment. How can you punish someone that's no longer here? And so they said that's not the main purpose of it.
That's why I raised those other two statutes. We have two statutes. One of them says people have been, they're unsound mind, incompetent. You can, and our legislature says you can get exemplary damages from them, even if they're unsound mind, if they knew at the time they did it. Now, what difference is that between a decedent who knew what he was doing was wrong and then passes away, as opposed to someone who became incompetent? I think the legislature is pretty much set the course that we need to follow it, really. But, I hope it isn't these employees here. The two statutes, the only two times the legislature has addressed it, they have said even minors, incompetent children, that in those cases, if you still get them, if you can go back and prove that they feel they're doing it, it's wrong. So I think, as I've argued in my brief, the fact that they haven't gone and applied a different rule to the states, one way or another, I think that we should assume that they expect the same kind of rationale to be applied to the states. I don't think
we should do it just like they would want to do it for them.
No, we can't do that, Judge, you know that. But the fact that they've done it twice already is a pretty good sign to me that it should weigh in favor of what I'm asking for to do in the states.
Okay, thank you, Counselor. Your time is up. Ms. Simmons, you have 20 minutes.
Support. Council, my name is Susan McSimons, and I am here representing the Appalachian Cross Appellant, Linda Kilcoyne, as a personal representative of Mr. L.J. Van Dyke and Van Dyke Supply Company. We're here to ask the court two things. First, we're here to ask the court to affirm Judge Tucker's conclusion that under South Dakota statutory law and case law, that the rule would be that punitive damages may not be assessed against the estate of a deceased tortfeasor. The second issue we've asked by way of notice of review is to take a preliminary look at Judge Tucker's ruling on a hearsay issue. I'd like to start with the issue of the punitive damages. And we believe that you have to look at four things, and when you look at those, Judge Tucker's decision is correct. I understand that this court reviews this issue de novo because it is an issue, I believe, of law. And that is under South Dakota law, under South Dakota statutes, can you assess damages against the estate of the deceased tortfeasor? And when you look at statutory construction, you look at the history of South Dakota's punitive damage provision, particularly by going back and looking at the Evans decision out of the state of California, which virtually specifically addressed this issue on the exact same statute. You look at the restatement of torts and what they've said on this issue, and you look at the majority of jurisdictions that have directly addressed this issue and held that such damages are not appropriate. And they're not appropriate because of the way our punitive damage statute is written. The punitive damage statute is written in the conjunctive. It states that punitive damages, in addition to actual damages, this court has already stated in Henry versus Henry that you cannot have punitive damages in the absence of compensatory damages. Again, looking at the very terms of the punitive damage provision. So if you go ahead and go beyond that provision, it says, may give damages for sake of example and by way of punishing the defendant. Now, the rules of statutory construction state you have to look at what the legislature said. We don't get to insert words. We don't get to take words out, we being the court, you being the court. What we have to do is look at what the legislature said. And in this case, they said the purpose of punitive damages is twofold. It's to deter, set an example, and it's to punish. And the majority of jurisdictions say if you can't meet both, then the statute prohibits punitive damages, and that's what is the result when you look at South Dakota's statute. And if you look at what this court has done, again, I know that in Henry versus Henry, they looked right at that language that said, quote, in addition to actual damages, the state, well, then you need compensatory damages. You have to go on. in the state of O'Keefe, in Clockhart versus Wyatt, in Schaefer versus Edward D. Jones, in each of those cases when this court has had an opportunity to take a look at the issue of punitive damages and the purpose of punitive damages, it has always stated it in the conjunctive, that the purpose is to punish the wrongdoer and deter others from similar wrongdoing. That's a quotation from this court in Holstein. In Flockhart versus Wyatt, this court said, to accomplish the objective of punishing the wrongdoer and deterring others from similar conduct. Again, a conjunctive two-pronged purpose for punitive damages as recognized by this court. South Dakota's pattern jury instruction 35-01 tells the jury, the purpose of awarding punitive damages is to set an example and to punish the defendant.
So you're saying because there can't be any punishment for this defendant, the judge is right?
I'm saying that that is what the majority has said. When you look at both prongs and you cannot satisfy, even the cases cited by Mr. Johnson that recognize and go the other way, all concur.
There's no question this could be a deterrent, though, is there?
Punitive damages are a deterrent. That is correct. But in Schaefer, they noted, this court also noted, it's not just a deterrent to others, but it's also a deterrent to the defendant. So there's two purposes of the deterrent prong. And again, with the decedent being deceased, obviously the deterrent to the tortfeasor is meaningless because he obviously cannot come and do the same type of actions that form the basis of the claim. It would be to deter others.
Is there any significance that Mr. Van Dyke sold the champion before he died?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I mean, Mr. Van Dyke was a businessman. Mr. Van Dyke
well,
was
you're talking about deterrence. He no longer owned the company before he died.
That's true. I would say at that point, the deterrence factor to him is also minimal because he wasn't going to do it again. He didn't have the same company. So you'd lose that in this case anyway.
No, but it deters other people in the future from, say, doing the same things that Mr. Johnson alleges, and then say, profiting from money. But let's go to the point of punishment for a minute and look at the average, normal, American, whatever you want to look at. Almost everybody, at least in the old days of my practice in law, had some inclination that, they wanted to leave something to their estate. They wanted to leave something to their children. They wanted to leave something to their heirs. They were saving for that purpose, including, saving for retirement and so forth. And assuming that Bert Van Dyke is a normal, average American person who has those interests at heart, isn't it normal to think that if he can escape now, isn't it normal to think that there would be some punishment to him through his estate if his estate is lessened, say, by the amount that the women's painting of the eyes enhanced the estate in the first place? So it seems to me that, the factor of punishment is there. It's the punishment of the person, but through his estate. And so I think that factor is there. And what do you have to say about that?
Well, I think that the dissent in that Harrelson decision, Your Honor, somewhat addresses the difficult position that the defendant is placed in, for example, in this situation. And that is, yes, could you punish him by taking this money out? But you know what? The defendant never gets to stand in front of that jury. Bert Van Dyke doesn't get to stand in front of this jury like a normal punitive damage case where, yes, you could say, yes, I put all this money for my heirs, and yes, I guess if the jury decides that I'm guilty, the jury gets to judge that person's credibility. That person gets to come in and attest to the issues of liability. But when the person is deceased, all you have is their heirs. They can't come in. So you're behind the eight ball in the issue of liability. And I think the court in the Harrelson decision in the dissent said that's why the punishment factor really loses it, because the jury can punish a person when they can see him and they can feel him and they can say yes. But you can't when they aren't even there to defend, and we'll get into that a little bit when we talk about my hearsay issue, statements that they supposedly made, 8, 9, 10 years ago that don't even surface until after they're dead.
Well, in a way, some of those arguments are answered by the rules of evidence, and for example, the second issue that relates to whether or not hearsay testimony can come in against Bert Van Dyke. obviously then hearsay testimony, if it's admissible, could come in favor of him and so forth. So once again, in a representative capacity, he's able to appear before the jury. But anyway, I think that's governed by evidence and evidentiary rules of the state of South Dakota. But there still is a punishment. There still is a punishment to him through his estate because this idea of leaving a lot to your children or whatever has been, would be diminished then, or at least would be held accountable for what might be called ill-gotten gains.
I think, you know, if you look at sort of what the court analyzed in the Dahl versus Sittner case, which is sort of, in my opinion, a little bit like this, and that is imposing punitive damages vicariously on the non-actor, which is what would be done here. It would be imposing the punitive damages on the heirs, the non-actors in this particular case. In Dahl versus Sittner, you stated that that's appropriate, but only generally if there's proof that somehow those innocent actors were not totally innocent. In other words, that they knew, or that they conceded, or that they approved the actions of the actual tortfeasor.
But we have countering principles of law in numerous cases that prevent, you know, or permit an action in quantum merit where somebody has benefited without really paying the price. If certain cases in principle that prevent through estoppel or latches or whatever, or certain cases that that prevent a windfall to someone who doesn't deserve it. And all of those principles are just, you know, could be argued to be equal as important as what you're expressing.
Well, I would say, Your Honor, that every court that has addressed it, particularly that issue, has determined that the punishment aspect does die with the tortfeasor, and I think that those decisions are very well reasoned, and I defer to them.
Can you think of a case, can you set us up this by memory, swearing that has adopted this conjunctive argument that you're making about our statute, about all the cases that you say?
Yes.
The there are three.
Three.
Uses that particular argument about you need conjunctive, and therefore, if you don't have both ways, you get nothing.
Well, the cases in Ohio, Alaska, and New Mexico all have the same or a very similar provision, whether it's by case law or statute, on the imposition of punitive damages. The Ohio decision is the Mongold versus Gilbert decision, where by case law they say two purposes for awarding punitive damages: to punish the tortfeasor and to make the tortfeasor a public example to warn others. Now again, that's not statutory, but it's their case law, and that case held that the purpose of punishment cannot be separated from the purpose of deterrence. In the Alaska case, Dole versus Colligan, again, case law, not statute, says that punitive damages are not only to punish the wrongdoer, but also to deter him and others like him from similar wrongdoing in the future, which is almost a verbatim quote from this court in the Schaefer case, precisely. And they went on to say, the central purpose of punitive damage is to punish the wrongdoer and to deter the future conduct. The goal of general deterrence depends significantly on the punishment function of the award of punitive damages. Since the decedent cannot be punished, the general deterrent effect becomes speculative at best, and thus, in our opinion, falls short of furnishing a justifiable ground for an award of punitive damages.
I think that was your firm's case, too, wasn't it?
That is a name that's familiar to my firm. Yeah. Right.
And in that, you were espousing that punitive damages should be awarded.
That case,
but in that case, the thing about it, we did not have a deceased actor in that case. So it really isn't a whole lot of precedent, is it?
No, it's precedent only for the fact that whenever this court talks about punitive damages, whenever it gives just the general rule regarding punitive damages, it always does so by stating both purposes.
What is the restatement rationale for saying that there shouldn't be recovery after that?
Well, I'm not sure that the restatement really gives a rationale, Your Honor. It simply states the rule, and I read the comments, and the comments to Part B are very limited. I think what it does is cites to the majority of jurisdictions that have directly addressed this issue in support of this contention. But it is, you know, directly on point talking about survival, and paragraph B says the death of the tortfeasor terminates liability for punitive damages. And this court has, on occasion, and quite consistently, looked to the restatement. In fact, that's what they did in Dahl versus Sittner in coming up with the vicarious liability concept. It's what they did in Schaefer. In fact, it was 909E that this court adopted in Schaefer, and this is, this would be 926.
Was that one or two?
Pardon?
Was that Schaefer 1 or 2?
I believe that was Schaefer 2. I don't recall the exact. I think you have to look at the Evans decision when you're looking at this issue of economics. That was not a drunk driving case. That was an economic case in the sense that I believe it had something to do with a land purchase that somebody backed out on, but it was not one of these types of torts. It was what would be considered more of an economic tort. Didn't bother the court. The court looked at the statute. The court looked at the field code. The field code is what South Dakota law is. This court recognized that again in Schaefer. They recognized it in Troutman. Our punitive damage statute can be traced to the field code.
Looking at it from a public policy standpoint, isn't it a little bit arbitrary that if these women work for Van Dyke Inc., a corporation that goes on after Mr. Van Dyke's death, they can seek punitive damages, but because it's a sole proprietorship and he's dead, they're out of luck?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because Mr. Van Dyke could have insulated himself from liability during his life by incorporating, by becoming a partnership, by paying taxes in a different manner. He chose to accept those liabilities by himself as a sole proprietor throughout the time that he was a businessman. And that shouldn't change or make any difference. Can I cite to a record citation on this? No. But I can tell you that Burt Van Dyke would rather be standing here and standing in front of a jury than being dead. This is not a situation where the defendant committed suicide in an attempt to avoid the imposition of punitive damages. This case was a very significant case to him, and he died.
Is there any, I see nothing in the briefs, is there anything in the record that reflects there's any continuing liability on the part of the Bellas for purchasing Van Dyke's for this existing responsibility?
No, we did produce the portion of the settlement agreement that indicated that all of the liabilities went with Mr. Van Dyke.
They stayed with him.
They stayed with him.
So there's no compensation coming from the Bellas?
The compensation for this?
For
the Bellas is not a party to this action.
So why is the company still?
Well, I'm not sure about that, Judge. At the time that the lawsuit was brought in 1994, the company still existed. It had not been sold. It was sold subsequent to the institution of this action. And, sole proprietors basically end at the time business ends, and it just is never, the caption has never been changed. But there's no doubt that Mr. Van Dyke was a sole proprietor.
I was thinking of the Landstrom case we had, and one of the individuals involved in that, a shaver, he passed away, but his estate was still responsible for any compensatory damages, and that's the same thing here.
Right.
And so dealing with is whether or not the punitive should be.
That's correct. All you're dealing with, it's a novel day in two reasons for this court. One, we're on the internet. Two, this is a case of first impression for this court. South Dakota has never directly addressed this issue. But it's interesting also when you look at the cases, Your Honor, that have addressed this issue, a lot of them look specifically at what is the policy in that state for punitive damages. For example, I do find it interesting that the Harrelson decision is cited quite frequently by the appellees. Look at Harrelson. Why were they comfortable in letting this go to the jury? Because in Arizona, the jury must impose punitive damages only if there's clear and convincing evidence of punitive damages. Well, this court has said that is not the standard in South Dakota. South Dakota is preponderance of the evidence even for the imposition of punitive damages. So you do not have the security that the Arizona courts had when they said, let's let the jury decide this question, because the jury's already up here at a very, very high standard of proof. So you've got to look at what these courts are saying that have gone outside the majority rule. Again, Harrelson also says, let's look at the type of conduct we think is outrageous. Mass murders, terrorist attacks, serial killings, those are the types of things they were talking about, public policy allowing for punitive damages. It also says that, punitive damages have other purposes in Arizona than they do in South Dakota, more than the two-prong. Look at Texas. I mean, Texas allows punitive damages for such thing as attorney's fees and additional compensation over and above that what they get in compensatory damages. For losses too remote to be considered compensatory. That's why Texas, that case specifically says the issue at hand must be decided on the basis of what Texas has decided punitive damages are for. And so you have to look at the cases that have gone contrary. Every single one of them can be distinguished from South Dakota law, and I did that in my brief.
Is there a point where the acts of the tortfeasor become so heinous that even if there is no profit to the tortfeasor, that punitive damages would be appropriate?
I don't know, Your Honor. I think it's a legal question of whether or not they can under the way our statute is written. If that's a decision, I think it's for the legislature to decide. The decision out of Minnesota where the woman was raped and attacked, and Minnesota didn't allow punitive damages, I mean, I think that's some pretty heinous actions. And they say, no, he's dead, you can't do it.
You mentioned terrorists in the Arizona case, that I'm a widower and I lost somebody on September 11th. I'm suing the state of Muhammad Atta for punitive damages. Under your argument, can I get him?
No. Is he dead? I'm sorry.
I see you through the first point.
Yes. Then you would not be allowed to get punitive damages to the state under that rule. And it's for the legislature to make this determination. If they want to do it, California ultimately codified this in their probate provisions that you cannot get damages against the estate by the other's decision. I only have a minute left. I'd like to touch real quickly, if I can, on the notice of review issue.
I'm going to ask you one thing. Maybe you don't know what it is, but we promise. But I do have to ask you about how do you respond to Mr. Johnson's argument in his brief, in his last brief? We're going to try to distinguish the California cases by saying that they were based on a survival statute.
Because Mr. Johnson was erroneous in that conclusion. The Whalen decision, which was decided, I don't have the year in front of me, Your Honor, talks about what I just told you, that in 1961, California codified the decision in Evans versus Gibson. But if you look at Evans versus Gibson, there was no, that statute that Mr. Johnson asserts the court was interpreting didn't exist. In fact, the court in the Whalen decision specifically noted that this amendment was a declaration of existing law. So he is incorrect in asserting that Evans was looking at the survival statute. Evans was looking solely at the punitive damage field code provision.
Justice Sabres has requested 1 minute because he would like you to address that second issue. 1 minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. As to the notice of review issue, we believe that one, the standard of review generally is abuse of discretion, but I think this, in this case, since the jury has never heard this testimony, they're actually in more of a clearly erroneous standard because it's really a preliminary determination of reliability, such as what would be held under the residual provision. And if you look at what must be done in the dead man statute, you have to have decedent good faith, decedent's personal knowledge, you have to have some corroborating evidence. Corroborating evidence isn't, I heard him say this. You have to look at the other facts. In every case that this issue has been looked at by the courts, they've said, okay, they say the decedent, and usually in an estate context, has said, let's go ahead, and oh yes, by the way, he did pay her, she did work for him, here's a power of attorney, here are all these facts that support what this assertion might be. In this case, there aren't. The record evidence is that Burt Van Dyke voluntarily cooperated with SDSU, he had ventilation, he had all of these things, and so the statements that supposedly were made simply aren't. There's not one corroborating piece of evidence other than these statements that appeared after his death.
How about the paint cans that the labels were removed?
The only evidence of that, again, is this individual saying, I saw the labels removed. The plaintiffs, two of the plaintiffs that saw and addressed and worked with the boxes said that the labels were on the boxes. And so did Gene Holm, and so did Bill Point. The only person that says the labels were ripped off, again, is the person that's coming in and
so
saying Mr. Van Dyke
Judge
said
Judge Tucker made, was clearly erroneous in making the finding that he did that was corroborating evidence and that those statements were made?
I'm saying that was an abuse of discretion, yes, and that there is, that the corroborating, he said two people hearing the statement and the labels being torn off. That was his corroborating evidence. The only people that heard the statement were the two people that came in and said it. And one of them, Mr. Fokish, I realize I'm way out of time and I apologize to the court if I may finish my answer, Justice Sabres. That Mr. Fokish didn't even hear it, he overheard. I mean, it wasn't even a statement said to him. And Gene Holm, and the other, two of the plaintiffs themselves have said the labels were on the computers.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Johnson, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Why don't you cover the notice of review issue?
Okay. Fine. Well, Judge Tucker, first of all, that dead man statute is not very applicable. It says that find evidence that was done in good faith, and actually the statements that were made here could hardly be called statements done in good faith. But at any rate, it does require under your decisions corroboration. I briefed that to Judge Tucker. It was briefed down below there. That fully there's I don't have that case at my fingertips, but we have a case that says you need corroboration to prove it. Judge Tucker said, first of all, we got corroboration. We got two witnesses. We don't have just one witness. We have two witnesses, independent witnesses that heard the same thing. Secondly, we do in fact have people that were suffered lead poisoning for sure. And thirdly, he says we have the labels. There's evidence that the labels were gone. Some of these people noticed that the labels were torn off of these barrels as they came up to their work. So he said, I find corroboration, and therefore I think it's admissible, and I think that that's a rule in this state. I cite that case that unless no judicial mind could find that way, that we should affirm Judge Tucker on that discretionary rule. I'm not going to have a lot to say about the other argument. It seems like perhaps, I think it's been picked up on that perhaps they're asking strictly for a statutory interpretation in this case because of this word and. Now, that word and does show up in some of those other states, but I think it's totally inconsistent when you say that they disregard the word and on incompetent people who become incompetent, and they disregard it for minor children. And therefore, it cannot be given the importance to which I think that they're arguing that it should have in this case, if this is strictly a matter of statutory interpretation. Statutory interpretation, and I need not tell you about that, involves a lot of issues, including public policy, morality, a lot of other things that we have to plug into this, and all of them, I think, favor the interpretation that I'm asking for in this case.
Have we had this a case where we've disregarded the statute for incompetence of that case?
Do we have, excuse me?
You said that this and is disregarded for cases where children are incompetent. Have we had a case like that?
If it requires both, as they argue, how can we have a statute that says that somebody who becomes totally incompetent, doesn't know anything? I mean, they can't be punished.
But that's how the legislature has spoken. That isn't how the court has. What you're saying, then, the legislature can disregard it, so we should.
Well, I think that they've shown that it's not always one, both of them. They've recognized that before, and I think it's logical to assume that we're I cite that Latin phrase, which I can't remember exactly what it was in my brief, but that recognition of one excludes the other, basically, and I think that it's not necessarily both elements in every case. That's a statutory interpretation issue.
But we haven't said that.
You haven't said that yet, no. This punishment issue.
How do you respond to it when someone's arguing? Responding to your argument about the California cases.
I just noted that they cited the California case, and I haven't reread that case, but I did notice that when the Whalen case that they thought was very significant does show that the statute, the California statute that I looked up, but I haven't cited in my brief, states that it does not survive. Their statute says it does not survive. A personal injury action survives, it says, except for punitive damages. Our statute just says personal injury actions about period. And the old authority that they cited, the Davis case, I can't remember exactly what the statute said, but I know that I was able to locate the California statute under the Whalen decision, which was in the last 40 years at least, and I thought it was more significant. This punishment issue, which I think you know, like they, I think it's quite, our legislature calls them exemplary damages. They don't say punishment damages. They refer to those other statutes as exemplary damages. Society, we're trying to, I suggest to you, the main purpose is to exemplify, make an example. And I think our legislature has shown that this year as to what they really are trying to do in society today. I thought about the argument of punishment that Judge Sabers raises about people wanting to, it is kind of a punishment if they know, well, maybe my heirs will not inherit all of my property if I do these acts. And the next thought that came to my mind is a lot of these cases, here's a question that maybe needs to be posed. We now have most people, for example, if they get cancer, they have a pretty clear window about how long they're going to live. Some of them say, what if they say, you're going to live about 6 months? Does that mean that he can take those 6 months to get even with people, to take economic advantage of people and to do everything he can to enhance his estate and then die, take away the wrongfulness, take that to the grave with him? I don't think that's right, but that's an interesting proposition to think of.
That's what a jury should be hearing, isn't it?
That's exactly right. I'd like that. That's a chance I'd like, Judge.
Yeah, but when you say the legislature has set a policy of exemplary, but is it still exemplary and? Is that and still in there?
The and is in the statute, but the later statutes on incompetence and minors uses the term exemplary. So that's my argument on that point.
Well, the legislature, we all know, I mean, the legislature has the right to control the
that. That is true. However, you have to plug those two in, Your Honor. I think you can't ignore them and say, well, the legislature had a bad day that day. I think we've got to say that they do what they were doing and they send it in so they can still recover from the conflict.
But that would only be in a case involving where they made that exception, wouldn't it?
That's right. I'm troubled, and I've raised it in my brief. They rather object to it, the fact that this is a company issue, really. We've got not only Bert Van Dyke, we've got his son-in-law, we've got his plant manager, we have a group of people that were involved in his actions. And
is the plant manager, is he related to him?
Well, the son-in-law, the assistant manager, the guy that was tearing the labels off was the son-in-law.
Is he
with him?
Is the plant manager a dependent in this?
No.
Oh.
Nor is the son-in-law. But where we have a company activity, and I sued the company, and I kept trying to think of a good argument as to why that's significant in this case, but it's a sole proprietorship. And there, it's a very interesting observation that Judge Gilbertson made, that if it had been a corporation, well, then we'd be in a different area again. I think that this cause of action for exemplary damages would not have died. So, that all goes back to, I guess, the economic aspects of this case, and I truly think that based on the prior public policy, based on the statutes, based on the general principle of morality, that you cannot bear the wrongfulness of this act with your bad idea. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. We will be in recess for approximately 10 minutes. See what the second case.